pretty invariable. That is pretty certain that storms are going to come in your life and in my life.
Jesus says
in this world we're going to have trouble and tribulation. So I guess you could say
almost that you are either on your way into a storm,
or you're in the midst of one,
or you're just
leaving one,
soon to head to another one. I was thinking a little bit about that as I was preparing for this morning, and reflected on what was a stormy time in my own life. It was my first mission trip back in 1993. We were still living in California at the time, and I got invited to join a team that was going to go and minister among the Karen. The Karen are a tribal people originally from Myanmar. What used to be Burma is now Myanmar, and since about 1948, there's been an ethnic war going on between the Burmese and some of the indigenous people that live in the land. The Burmese want to assimilate everybody into one culture, one people, and the Karen, among others, don't want to be assimilated that way. And so, much like what you heard years ago about the trouble in Bosnia and Serbia, the same kind of thing going on there. And so I got invited to join a team that was going to go minister among the Karen. The Karen, by and large, live as a dispossessed people. They live in refugee camps along the Thai-Burma border.
There's a little stretch of land called Kafalay
that they hold. They have held with a military presence on the Thai-Burma border. And so we were going to make that trip.
I went to encourage
and to teach and to speak to the leaders of the church among the Karen, because there's quite a Christian presence among them. It was an exhausting journey, a long plane ride from California all the way to Southeast Asia, and then another long plane ride to where we were finally going, and then it was a
trip by truck and van into the jungle. It took us a long way to get densely into the jungle. Here's a shot. This is a picture of, I don't know how the guy knew where to stop. We were driving through triple canopy rainforest, and the driver of the pickup truck we were riding in just stopped, and someone came up through the jungle and started to haul our luggage away. That's my suitcase going away down in through the jungle, and I decided, I guess this is where we're getting out. And so we all got out and followed the luggage down into this ravine and found the refugee village that we were going to spend the week at. This is what it looked like when we arrived. Beautiful valley, but there you see the little buildings there in the jungle. That's where we stayed, and for a while I was there and did some teaching. We taught in this building. This was the nicest building in the refugee camp. That was the place where the teaching was for that first week. It was a remarkable experience to be there. I wasn't exactly sure what to expect. The team leader told me a little bit about what to anticipate when I arrived there. But when I got there, it was huge for me. In fact, I was looking over my journal, the journal I wrote when we were there. I didn't tell you about the spiders. Literally as big as my hand. There was one living in the shed that we were living in. He was up in the rafters. We didn't know how to get him down, but that's where he was living. And in my journal entry on that first day in the refugee camp, I wrote these words: "It's very oppressive. Depressive and discouraging, right in the middle of the jungle. Although the scenery is beautiful, the living conditions," I just put an exclamation point. I didn't know even how to describe it. "I could not live here long unless the Lord were to give me great grace. I feel afraid. I'm afraid of bathing. I'm afraid of sleeping. I'm afraid of eating. I'm even afraid of going to the bathroom." I mean, it was that visceral, that troubling. And then I recalled the form that Sue had to sign when I agreed to go on the mission trip. We had done all the normal kind of arrangements, and the team leader brought a form to our house and said, "Now, Sue will have to sign this form before we let you go." And the form basically was an agreement that if I were to die on the trip, she would not petition to have my body returned to the States. And I realized I could die here and no one would even know where my body was. And there was still war going on. I mean, even to this day, you can look up the Karen on Google and find that there's still war going on between the Karen and the Burmese. And yet, even at that time, I would ask, so there's still war going on. There were some of the people in the refugee camp who had been fighting on the front. the skirmishes that were fought. And one of the guys said, oh, yeah, sometimes we can hear gunfire from the front. And I'm thinking, great. And he says, but it's okay because it's a two-week trek through the jungle to get there from here. So even though you can hear the gunfire, it's a long way off. But there I was, and I'm thinking, what have I gotten myself into? And I am literally terrified of even going to sleep that first night in the camp. And so I did what we all do, and we're afraid. I prayed. Seems like the right thing to do, isn't it? Doesn't it seem like the right thing to do when you're terrified, when you're frightened, when you're afraid, when you face the terrible, the troubling, the frightening, when we are dealing with things that take us beyond ourselves? Praying is the right thing to do. Calling out to Jesus, that's what I did. Whether it's troubles in life, or troubles in marriage, or trouble with your children, or even trouble with your parents, if you are the children, challenges at work, or problems in school, maybe it's family issues, needs that you don't know how to address. Maybe it's financial downturns, the loss of a job. Maybe it's disease in your body or in the body of a friend or loved one that won't respond to treatment. Maybe it's the fear of living alone. Or maybe it's the fear of giving yourself to someone for a lifetime with uncertainty as to how that future life is going to play out. The gnawing anxiety of what tomorrow will bring, more heartache, more trouble, another trial. When you are feeling overwhelmed, overtaken, overthrown, on the verge of being undone, when you face that trouble and those difficulties and the storms that come, what will you do? Well, it seems right to pray, and so that's what we do. We pray. We cry out to Jesus. And candidly, that is what troubles me so much about the passage that we're going to look at this morning. Because where we're going to be in the Gospel of Mark is where the disciples are facing trouble in a very tangible way. It's a storm. And they cry out for help from Jesus.
And he rebukes them.
What? I don't understand that. They're praying in the time of trouble and something doesn't seem to quite be right. And we need to wrestle with that because it is exactly what I do. In the midst of trouble, I cry out to him and that's what they do. And somehow there's a problem. There's a disconnect. We're in this journey in the Gospel of Mark. Why? Well, because truth be told, life is really about who you know. But there's just one that you really need to know. You just really need to know Jesus. Life is about knowing Jesus. Relationship with Jesus is instrumental. It's critical. It's crucial to experience life. If you don't know Jesus, if you don't have a relationship with Jesus, if you're not living in relationship with Jesus, you're not really experiencing life. But the truth is, there are a lot of imaginary Jesuses. A lot of people who have conceptions about Jesus that are not the Jesus of the Bible, who relate to an imaginary Jesus, a Jesus of their own creation, and then they have an imaginary kind of life. But we want to have real life, understand what life is really like, experience real life with God, and the only way to do that is to have a relationship with the real Jesus. So some months ago, we began a journey through the Gospel of Mark. Because Mark is one who can tell us who the real Jesus is. Church history tells us that Mark's Gospel is written on the basis of Peter's reminiscences. Peter is one of those who walked with Jesus every day. Peter is the one who tells the story about Jesus. Mark writes it down for us, and that's what we have in the Gospel of Mark. Eyewitness, first-hand encounters with Jesus. And it's really clear in the passage we look at today when we get to see Peter's experiences in the boat with Jesus in the midst of a difficult time, and it reads just like we were there. And we need to understand it that way. And we need to take a close look at it. It's in Mark chapter 4. Would you turn with me there? And we're going to take a look at how these disciples responded to Jesus in a time of need and what it might say to us. Mark chapter 4, I'm going to start in verse 35. On that day, the day Jesus was teaching, he had been explaining to the disciples what the kingdom life was all about and taught them in parables. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, to the disciples, let's go across to the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat just as he was. Jesus had been teaching from the boat. So now he said, let's go to the other side. And so they take him just as he was in the boat. And there were other boats there. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling up. But Jesus was in the stern asleep on the cushion, and they woke him and said to him, Teacher, don't you care that we are perishing? And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, Peace, be still. and the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, why are you so afraid? Why is it that you don't yet have faith? And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? Now, short account, but packed with eyewitness kind of details, and it's helpful for us if we can imagine ourselves in that scenario, because it'll make the account more rich and meaningful. You need to use your sanctified imagination and climb into that boat. It wouldn't have been just a little rowboat. It would have been a rather large fishing vessel. Hold 15, 16, 17 guys. This time it's got 12 disciples and Jesus. Probably had oars for rowing, but maybe also a sail. It's the kind of boat that had been out on the Sea of Galilee, this large lake in northern Palestine, many times. These guys were accomplished, comfortable in the boat. Many of them were fishermen. They made their living doing this. They've been on the sea a lot, a lot. Now, the Sea of Galilee sits as in a valley in the mountains, and because of the atmospheric conditions in northern Palestine where the Sea of Galilee is, it's not uncommon for storms to just whip up. The winds blow down in through the valleys and stir up trouble on the sea. These guys have been there before. They know what it's like. They've been on the sea. They made their living on the sea. Many of these guys have spent their whole life in and around the Sea of Galilee. So a storm arising is not a big deal, but this is a big storm. And so they are there in the boat trying to make their way across. The waves are crashing. The wind is blowing. And the boat is already filling up. These guys are now afraid. These aren't guys like me. Don't put me out on a boat. I don't want to go out on a boat. These guys live on a boat. They're very comfortable there. This must have been quite some storm. And as the storm is stirring and the boat is beginning to fill up, they are afraid for their lives. What do they do? Look back and there's Jesus. Maybe under a piece of sailcloth. He's sleeping. He's had a long day teaching. He's tired. He's resting on the cushion. And they look back there and they decide, we better wake him up. But you know what? Let's be honest. I don't think they woke him up because they thought he was going to calm the storm. Because they have never seen him do that kind of thing before. Right? They've seen him heal sick people. They've heard him teach. He's delivered a few people who have been demonized. But they've never seen anything like this. So why'd they wake him up? I think they must have woken him up because they thought maybe he could do something. Like bail. We need some help. We're going under. We're rowing. You're sleeping. At least you could do is help us bail. They woke him up because they thought he could do something. I don't know that they knew what was going to happen. But they do just what you and I do in the midst of trouble. We go to Jesus and say, can't you help? Won't you do something? That's what they did. They certainly thought Jesus could do something. I don't think they knew what he was going to do. But at least he could help bail. They do what you and I do in the midst of trouble and fear. In the midst of our anxious nights and troubled days, I call to Jesus and ask him for help. And what bothers me about this account is that they do what I do, and they got a rebuke. Did you notice? They go to him, and they wake him up, and then once he calms the storm, he turns to them and goes, hey guys, I have any faith. What is with that? You know what? I think it seems to me, it's a mild rebuke, but it's a rebuke nonetheless. But it seems to me that the thing that faith does is comes to Jesus with needs. That's what we've been seeing in the Gospel of Mark so far. I got needs. I come to Jesus. That seems to be faith. In fact, the first place that faith is mentioned in the Gospel of Mark is chapter 2, where four guys bring a paralyzed friend to Jesus. They hear that Jesus is healing people. They're hearing that this is the kind of thing that he does. So when Jesus is in town, they come bringing their friend, carrying him on a pallet. He can't walk. Maybe Jesus can do something about it. They can't get close enough to him. So they dig through the roof and lower their friend down. And Mark tells us that Jesus, seeing their faith, speaks a word of healing, both the soul and body of their paralyzed friend. What was going on? These four friends were bringing somebody in need to Jesus. That seems to me to be part of what faith is all about. When I have trouble, I come to Jesus because I think he can do something about it. That's what I do. That's what you do. That's what they did. And yet Jesus rebukes them. That bothers me. Because what am I going to do when I'm in trouble? I'm going to call on Jesus, and yet Jesus rebukes them. They come to him in the midst of trouble and cry out for help, and he rebukes them. What justifies his rebuke? Why is it legitimate for Jesus to question them? I think two things. lead me to understand what's going on here. And they're both found in what the disciples themselves say. Notice what they say when they wake him. Verse 38. But Jesus was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they woke him and said to him, Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Clearly, they woke him because they thought he could help in some way. Otherwise, they wouldn't wake him. Oh, he's useless. Don't bother to wake him up. Clearly, they woke him because they thought he could do something. They're not saying, we don't think you can do anything to help. They woke him because they thought he might do something. But what are they saying? Notice they say, don't you care? Here's the first thing that suggests there might be something a little missing in their faith. They wake him saying, don't you care? We really have doubts about whether you care. I think that's part of the problem of their faith. What have they seen? What have they seen of Jesus to this point? Well, after Jesus teaches in the synagogue in Capernaum, they tell him about Simon's mother-in-law. And what does he do? He comes to her and takes her by the hand and lifts her up and restores her. Why does he do that? They start bringing him those who are sick with various diseases, and he heals them. Why does he do that? A leper comes to him and falls on his knees before Jesus and beseeches him and says, if you're willing, you can make me clean. And Mark tells us, Jesus moved with compassion, stretches forth his hand and touches him and says, I'm willing to be clean. What are they saying about Jesus? Everywhere Jesus goes, people are ministered to. Why? Because Jesus is compassionate, and he's tender, and he's kind, and he cares. Everything that they've seen about Jesus up to this point would underscore the fact he really cares. People really matter to him. People really matter to him. That's everything that they've seen. And yet, in the midst of their trouble, they question, well, I wonder if he really cares. Boy, how like me that is. How like me that is. You know, it's quite unlikely that I ever doubt that Jesus can do something. I got that piece. He upholds all things by the word of his power. He flung the stars in the sky. There's pretty much nothing that he can't do. In the midst of my trouble, I don't question really whether he can do something or not. The reason why I'm going to him and asking him in prayer for help is because I think he can do something, just like these guys who come to Jesus in the midst of their trouble, asking him to do something. Why are they coming? Because they believe he can do something. What's their struggle? Same struggle that I have. I wonder if he cares enough to do anything. I wonder if I matter enough to him. See, the truth is, I really believe that Jesus loves you. So in the midst of your trouble, I know he's going to do something. I know he's going to show up. I know he's going to make his care known. Because I know he loves you. But I sometimes wonder, does he just tolerate me? Do I really matter? Does he really care? And so I do the same thing that the disciples do. I come to him in the midst of my trouble, and I raise the question of his care. I come in the midst of trouble because I believe he can do something. But I wonder, does he really care? The truth is, I don't think it is primarily an issue of identity. What I mean by that is, I don't think that this is primarily, oh, they didn't understand who he was. Even though at the end, when they say, who is this, that even the wind and sea obey him, I don't think that primarily the struggle is getting the identity piece right. You know why I know that? Because you all got the identity piece right and you still wonder if he cares in the midst of your struggles, right? I talk to people all the time who are in the midst of difficult times. I see it and taste it in my own life. In the midst of difficult times, maybe it's a struggle in relationship, maybe it's a struggle at work, maybe it's a struggle with family, friends, parents, children, maybe it's financial hardship. And when I talk to people or I listen to my own soul, is Jesus the one who flung the stars in the sky, the one who upholds all things by the words of his power, the one who's coming back to set everything right? Is Jesus capable of doing something about that? Yep, he really is. So why are you panicked? Why are you frightened? Why are you troubled? Because I question whether he cares enough to do something about it. That's the first part of their struggle. In the midst of this storm, they raise the question, do you care? And that's just like me. But Jesus has such an excellent track record that if they merely looked at his track record, they'd go, well, of course he cares. What prompts Jesus' rebuke is not, oh, you don't fully yet realize who I am. They already knew enough to know they could go to him for help. His rebuke comes because you're not resting in the reality of my care for you. You really wonder if I care for you. How can you wonder that after all we've been through? So that's the first part of it that I think enters into where my struggle comes, where their struggle comes. Why Jesus, when they come to ask him for help, why Jesus feels it right to rebuke them. How come you don't have faith? How come you're not resting, trusting, abiding in me? Because you wonder about my care. How can you wonder about my care? But there's something else here also. Something else in their question that I think prompts Jesus' rebuke. Notice what they say. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? I think that provokes some of Jesus' response. Now, first, let me tell you what I think that this doesn't mean. They raise the question, we're perishing. And I've heard people look at this passage and teach, oh, no, they were wrong. They couldn't be perishing because Jesus was in their boat. And no boat where Jesus is in the boat will the boat ever go down. That is not what the passage is teaching. How do I know that? Ask Paul, who was in a boat that went down. You read about the book of Acts where Paul was on his way to the city of Rome. What happens? He gets shipwrecked. Well, Paul, why didn't you just quote the idea that no boat that Jesus is in will go down? No, he couldn't. In fact, Jesus told him in the midst of that, he says, oh, by the way, Paul, the boat's going down. I'll spare you, but the boat's going down. It's not true. It is not true that if Jesus is in your life, then, quote, your boat will never go down. You're going to have trouble. Your boat may sink. Just think about those whose lives have been martyred for the sake of the faith. Their lives were forfeit. And it wasn't because Jesus wasn't in their boat. It wasn't, in fact, because Jesus was. Even better, Book of Acts, Peter, filled with the Spirit, preaches the gospel on Pentecost. 3,000 respond. We go, that's what Jesus does, right? Next chapter, Peter and John, filled with the Spirit, preaching the gospel, speak to the Sanhedrin. Nobody responds. Huh. Was God in that? Absolutely. A couple chapters later, Stephen, filled with the Spirit, preaching the gospel. What happens to him? He gets stoned. Which is the thing God is doing? All three. All three. So you got to hear me really clearly. I'm not saying this means that whatever trouble you're going through, if Jesus is with you, the trouble won't go by. You'll be... No, I can't say that. But that they raise the issue of we're perishing, I think, in this instance, is part of the problem of their faith. And here's why. You got to understand, this problem that arises in their cry is rooted in what has been going on leading up to this. Jesus is a great teacher. You know what Jesus does oftentimes? He will, and he does this in your life and my life, he does this with their lives also. He'll teach, he'll instruct, he'll inform us on something, and then he'll go, now, you need to get your arms around that, so let's have a lab. Seriously. It's the instruction and then the practicum. There is the teaching and then the lab. There is the information and then the practice. And this is the day that Jesus has been teaching. What has he been teaching? He's been teaching them in parables. And we go back in chapter 4 and begin to look at the parables. What's the first parable he taught? It was about the parable of the sower. The sower who sows the seed. And when the disciples asked and came to him and said, explain to us what that parable is about. We spent some weeks on that. What was that parable all about? It is about paying attention to what Jesus says. That was the point of the parable. Jesus drives it home by saying, be careful to what you pay attention to. Watch what you listen to, because what you listen to is critical for your life in the kingdom. So the parable of the sower is about, do you listen to what Jesus is saying? That was the point of the parable of the sower. And then it was followed up by two little parables that Charlie talked with us last week about. Jesus teaches two other little parables. The first is about the seed that grows secretly. The farmer goes out and he sows seed, and he goes to sleep at night, and he sleeps and doesn't know, but the seed grows up. The seed produces automatically. What was the point of that parable? What God sows, he will bring fruit from. You may not know how it's going to happen. It will produce the right results. Jesus sowing seed in the lives of people, it will produce the right result. And he follows it up with a little parable about the mustard seed. A little teeny, teeny seed produces something amazing. As we pull those three parables together, what is Jesus saying? Jesus is saying, pay attention to what I tell you. You may not understand how what I tell you is going to produce the results it will. You may think what I say is so small compared to what the need is. what I'm telling you is going to produce the right result. Jesus has been teaching them that. He says, this is the secret of kingdom life. Pay attention to what I tell you. And so then the disciples get a lab. And when they raise the question about perishing, it's because they haven't done very well in the lab. Because what has Jesus told them? Look at what he says to them when they get in the boat. Verse 35. And on that day, when evening had come, Jesus said to them, let's go into the middle of the sea and drown.
We may have somebody said. He doesn't say that. He says, let's go over to the other side. I don't want you to think about this in magical ways. But Jesus told them, we're going to the other side. Did they listen to that? Apparently not. Because they say, we're going to die. Wait, I told you we're going to the other side. Did they rest in what he said, assuming that what he said was going to bear fruit? He's sleeping. They're panicking. What's the difference? He knows what he said is going to come to pass. They're clueless. They're not listening. They're not paying attention. That little word doesn't seem very significant in the midst of the storm that they're in. And they respond the wrong way. They don't pay attention to what he has said to them. And they question, are we going to die? No, guys, you're not. I already told you. We're going to the other side.
Now, you got to hear me. This is not about the power of positive thinking. This is not about getting what you want. This is not even about a blanket promise that Jesus will always calm the storms in our lives. Jesus does not always calm the storms in our lives. This is not about even claiming promises in the midst of the trouble, looking for something that you can leverage to get God to do what you want Him to do. That's not what this is about. This is about, did you listen to what Jesus told you? It is not about their preferred future. We'd like to survive, Jesus, and we're really panicked that we're going to die. Jesus isn't rebuking them about that. His rebuke comes because you didn't listen to what I said. There's an amazing passage in the book of Acts where Paul, in his walking with Jesus, comes to hear from Jesus, Paul, I'm sending you to Jerusalem, and there you'll be handed over to the religious leaders, and then you're going to be sent to Rome, and there you're going to die. Jesus tells Paul that. So Paul's on his way to Jerusalem, and he meets a prophet by the name of Agabus. And Agabus says, the Lord is saying that if you go to Jerusalem, you're going to be handed over. Paul goes, yeah. Agabus says, so don't go. Paul goes, I'm going. Why? This is heard what the Lord wants for him, and that's what he's giving himself to. To question that is to not live in faith. Dependence, rest, reliance on Jesus. It's not that the disciples were not getting their preferred future that raised the question of their lack of faith. It was because they hadn't been paying attention to what Jesus said. Sometimes in the midst of the storm, he will say, we're going through to the other side. Sometimes in the midst of the storm, he may say, the boat is going down. But the question is, will you listen to him in the midst of it? They didn't. That was the problem. It is not, you got to hear me, it is not about a blanket promise that all the storms in your life will be calmed, because he doesn't promise that. But it is in this moment, in this situation that I find myself, am I listening to what he's saying? Am I taking him at his word? Do I really believe, accept, rest in, depend on what he has said? And in this moment, they haven't. And you know what? The truth is, in most of my storms, I don't either. I don't pay much attention to what he's saying. I just want to figure out what to do to get out of the storm. Let me think out loud with you a little bit about what that might be like. In that first mission trip that I took, I told you how I was fearful and panicked. Hardly slept that first night. I tucked my mosquito netting around my bedroll really good. And slept like this, praying. Why? Because I was afraid. So the first thing that the Lord had to wrestle with me about was, Brian, do I really care for you? Do you really believe that I care for you? Yes, Lord, I guess. You have such a good track record. I know that you care for me. But then I had to wrestle with, what had he promised me about this? He hadn't promised me that I would come through. He simply promised me I have an opportunity to share him with other people. I mean, that's what he said. Will you go and share about the gospel with the Corinth? Absolutely. I'm jazzed about that. But I didn't ask him, am I coming back? I know that's kind of a weird thing to say on a morning when we're talking about short-term mission trips.
But you got to understand the reality of that. I was speaking with a really good friend of mine, just a great brother in the Lord, some weeks ago, longer than that, about a year and a half ago. He was going on a medical mission trip to Africa. He'd been before, and he was going on another trip, and this time he was going out into the bush in a kind of adventure that he had not been on before, and he actually was fearful for his life. He wondered about how risky this was and what it meant for his family and his children. And over a couple of weeks, we sat over breakfast and talked about it. And I remember when he came one morning and said, you know what, I'm really okay with this if I don't come back. Because Jesus is just giving me the opportunity to go and love people. That's what he told me. He told me that he'll take care of my family, whether I'm here or not. I mean, and he began to listen to what Jesus was telling him in the midst of it, and that's what he could hold on to. It wasn't about his preferred future. It wasn't about my preferred future in Thailand. It wasn't about the disciples' preferred future. We'd like not to drown in the midst of the sea. That wasn't what the issue was. The issue was, did you listen to what Jesus was saying about your life? The obstacle to faith is not to pay attention to him. So maybe it's in your business. And you're struggling in the midst of your business and things are not looking well and you're troubled and having sleepless nights. And the first question is to be resolved is, do you realize he really does care? He really does care about you in the midst of your trouble. And obviously, yes, he does. His track record is too good to doubt that. But the second question is the harder one. The second question is, so what has he said to you about your work? What has he said to you about your business? You know, I can look through the scriptures, and unless you receive some specific revelation from God, I can look through the scriptures, and he has not promised that your business will be successful. He doesn't. He says you should work so that you have stuff to give away. Thessalonians, Paul's letter, doesn't say you should work so that you have a really big hunkin' IRA waiting for you when it's all over. Now, that's nice. I mean, if God provides that way, but he hasn't promised, he hasn't said to any of us that he'll provide massive retirement money. Maybe, maybe not. He hasn't promised you that your business will be successful. He's promised that you'll have work to do so that you can give to those who are in need. And he's promised that he'll meet your needs. If you seek first the kingdom, then everything else that you need will be given to you. So in the midst of your troubling business situation, are you listening to what he is saying? If you don't, you will tend to panic and you will wake him and want to know, don't you care that my business is going down the tubes? And Jesus will go, I care for you. What's your business? I have other plans. Do you understand what I'm saying? Listening to him in the midst of it. If you're in marital difficulties, sometimes, well, in this crowd, there's probably nobody going through marital difficulties. Maybe you know somebody who sometimes may be going through marital difficulties. In the midst of the marital difficulties, the chafing that goes on between husbands and wives, I will talk to couples, and the husband will come or the wife will come, and they'll say, this is just not what I thought it was supposed to be. What is God doing? And I will ask them, what it was that you thought Jesus was doing? Well, giving me my preferred future. Giving me that spouse. I've been working on my spouse for 6 years, and they still haven't changed. They think that God put them in the marriage to change somebody else, and then we will back up and we will start to ask questions about what does Jesus really say about your marriage? Let me bottom line it for you. You know what I think Jesus says about marriage? Marriage is your lab where you get the opportunity to learn to love somebody the way he loves you. I don't think he promises you more than that. Now, sometimes there is more than that. But that's not what your marriage is not to get you to be able to suck life out of somebody else and get them to give you everything that you think you need. Your marriage is the opportunity for you to give your life away to somebody else. And if you understood that, then in the midst of the trouble, you'd go, okay, what is Jesus telling me? And he's telling me, this is my opportunity to grow up to love somebody like he loves me. And if I listen to what he says, then I know how to rest on him and depend on him. And I know what to call on him for in the midst of my trouble. And I don't panic and wake him up and say, don't you care that I'm not getting my preferred future? And Jesus in grace comes and helps me, but doesn't always give me my preferred future. In the
It's amazing. You watch in the book of Acts as the church unfolds their journey, as Luke records it for us. And Acts chapter 2, Peter stands up and he preaches and thousands respond, but it's not very long before the religious leaders start to be very troubled by what's going on in the early church. And they start harassing, threatening Peter and John. The church continues to pray and move forward. Ultimately, they're told no longer speak anymore in this name. Some are beaten. James is martyred. Stephen is killed. And how is the church living in the midst of all of this? It says that they rejoiced that they were being given the opportunity to suffer for his name's sake. Why? Because they heard what Jesus had said. Jesus didn't say, you guys are going to have such a great time being a church in Jerusalem. Everyone's going to love you. That isn't what Jesus said. Jesus didn't say, things are going to get better and better for you while you live here. That isn't what Jesus said. Jesus said, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you will be my witnesses. Period. Ooh. That's what he said. And that's what they were living. That's what they went, yes, we know what we're all about. What this life is all about. Because I've listened to what Jesus said. In the midst of the storm on the Sea of Galilee, it wasn't primarily about we're not getting what we want. It was primarily about, did you listen to what I said? I'm doing in your life. That's the way through the storm. And I raised the wrong question, and I prayed the wrong way, and I cry out to Jesus in a way that may get a mild rebuke. When I think it's about what I want and how I want, and I question his care, and I don't listen to what he said. In times of trouble, my lack of dependence rests on him comes because I doubt his care, even though he has a proven track record. And in times of trouble, my lack of dependent rest in him comes because I have questions about what he's doing, but only because I have not been listening well. So I thought about, how might the disciples have experienced this a little differently? They're in the boat, and the storm is raging, and they are fearful for their lives. Times get like that. But what would a response to faith look like? Yeah, it's going to wake them up. It's crying out to Jesus. But I think the way I approach him says everything about what I'm thinking. I think the way they could have done it, perhaps the way they should have done it, was to come to Jesus and say, we know you care. That's why we're waking you. We know we matter. That's why we're here. And we know what you've said. You've told us we're going to the other side. I just don't see it. I don't know how it's going to happen. What do you want to do about it? That would be the way forward. So the storms are coming. And trusting in his care and listening carefully to what he says to you is the way we move through it. Let's pray. In your word, by your spirit, through the counsel and advice of others, we hear you speak to us, Jesus. And you have very clear things to say to us about what you're doing in our lives and where we're headed, what you want. Forgive me for not listening, because when I don't listen, then I panic. Forgive me for overlooking your care. Because when I take my eyes off of that, I panic. I want the freedom to come to you in the midst of my storms and invite your help. We want that. But we long for it in the right way. So stir in us a confidence in your care. And give to us ears to hear so that we might know what it is that you are doing in our lives, individually and collectively. And then, we're just going to settle down there. We're just going to rest there. That'll see us through the storms.